before diving back into the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, here's another poem by Dongshan, the same author, about the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, I would say. He doesn't use these words, but see if this sounds like similar instructions pointing to mirror awareness. This doesn't seem to be in Dongshan's usual record, but Thomas Cleary has translated this, attributed to Dongshan. It's called Secret of the Mind Elixir. Yeah, elixir, I guess, like a long life, infinite life, medicine, maybe ambrosia, nectar. Also like in Taoist alchemy, like something that changes base metals into gold. So it's maybe in this Taoist sense, because he talks about an oven. The Secret of the Mind Elixir. I have a medicine called Elixir of Mind. For years it's been refined in the oven of afflictions, till I recognized its unchanging color in the matrix, shining with radiance illuminating the universe. It opens the eye of reality to see with minute precision. It can change the ordinary mortal into a sage instantly, to discern the real and the false, to complete the work, see to refinement at all times. It has no shape or form. It's not square or round. There are no things in words. There are no words in things. Deliberate exploitation is contrary to true function. When meditating with no intention, everything is Zen. It neither goes dead nor gets aroused. Everything is at its command. Even the land, wherever the place, when put in this oven, is it. My idea is to have no particular idea. My knowledge is to have no particular knowledge. There is uniformity, no indifference. When the appearance does not change, it's harder to discern. When nothing more appears within, don't use anything to stabilize it. Experiential merging with real emptiness is not cultivation. It's in Thomas Cleary's Five Houses of Zen, in the section on the Soto School. Beautiful poem, I think. And similar, you know, maybe the language is a little different, but similar, pointing to this Jewel Mirror Samadhi and the mind of this meditation on suchness. Particularly, I think, as meditation, Zazen instructions, these lines of, my idea is to have no particular idea. My knowledge is to have no particular knowledge. It's a little bit like thinking without thinking. That's Secret of the Mind Elixir. The last line, actually the last four lines are... when nothing more appears within, don't use anything to stabilize it. I think that's wonderful too. Experiential merging with real emptiness is not cultivation. So, it's not deliberate cultivation, like deliberate intentional practice. Experiential merging with real emptiness is not some practice that you cultivate. It's not something that you do. It's the natural nature of mind. You know? And when nothing more appears within, when we're just resting in mirror-like awareness, don't use anything to stabilize it. It's very similar to like, okay, we got it. Just like, don't disturb me here. Just, you know, or let's, you know, don't let any thought intrude on this. Let's make it really stable and strong. You know, sometimes we hear meditation like that, but this is, don't do anything about this. When you get here, don't use anything to stabilize it. Because that very slight intention or effort to bring something in to stabilize it actually disturbs it. Very subtle meditation or non-meditation, not doing anything in particular, and yet it's shining with radiance, illumining the universe. So now, in a way, that poem was a little bit more straightforward. This dual mirror samadhi actually is really brings up this whole dialectic of the apparent and the real, again and again in many ways, which we're getting into that section now. We left off at somewhere about 7 or 8 lines down. It's bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. Again, this is about these five positions of the relative and the ultimate. The ultimate here being used as this, the character that means the true, the apparent and the true, we could say, or the real. There's five lines in here where this character for real or true appears. So it's in that line there in the Chinese, where it says it's bright just at midnight, it doesn't appear at dawn. It's the third character from the left. So if you note that character, you can look down, you can find it five more times in the poem. I'll point them out when we get there. But one theory is that these five places where this appears are referring to these five positions of the apparent and real. That's one theory, which is not bad if you start lining them up. We're going to have to get into this gnarly territory pretty soon, I think, these five positions.
When you say that means true?
It means true. It's actually the show of Shobogenzo, which means the true Dharma eye treasury. So you could translate it as true, real, upright. And the other character that doesn't appear until later, that Dongshan's using here for these two sides of reality, we could say apparent or relative, but literally means inclined. So maybe it's a kind of poetic way of saying upright and inclined, or upright and leaning. Mm-hmm. Upright is ultimate truth, isn't leaning in any direction, almost like the middle way, and then leaning into like existence or non-existence, maybe we could say. It's just the image of inclined or leaning goes with the relative or conventional truth.
Where is the word inclined or leaning?
So I think it only appears once in dual mirror samadhi, quite a few lines down where it says it's like the six lines of the illumination hexagram, relative and ultimate interact. So yeah, there's the true. So the one just before the true means inclined or leaning. So when it's bright, if we're trying to bring out the this emphasis on the true in these five lines, I would, you know, it seems like that these translators here, and almost none of the translators picked up on that and wanted to like bring out that point. But I think it's nice if we could translate it as the true is bright at midnight. Literally, those characters are like night in the middle, true, bright. That's how that line goes. So it's like in the middle of the night, the true or real or ultimate is bright. I think is a nice translation. And then it doesn't appear at dawn. So the true is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. You know, our translation doesn't... Maybe the just is kind of like emphasizing true or real, but it kind of misses that. The true or reality... ultimate, the ultimate is bright just at midnight, and now we're bringing in this dark and light metaphors that's going to get really played out here. The darkness is the realm of the true, where you can't distinguish forms and differences and distinctions. It's uniformly, you can't see anything, right, in the dark. And the light is where we distinguish forms and particulars and the relative world. So light and dark like that, and there's going to be these different colored circles coming and I Ching hexagrams and all of this that are all woven into this dark and light, yin and yang images. It's particularly bringing, one theory is it's like the early days still of Zen in China, and it's trying to really Chinese-ify it. Bringing these Indian Dharma teachings into China, which is already was completely immersed in the world of the I Ching and Yin and Yang and Taoist thought and so on.
But interestingly, maybe in my mind, I'm also associating the jewel mirror with the ultimate, the absolute, and yet. It's, you know, both jewel mirrors about light and healing. So it's another instance of, you know, where you think you've got a concept or even a picture in my head. It's not that.
Yeah, it's very dynamic. And when we try to start matching up all these different symbols, it's not so simple and straightforward. It gets, and there's arguments within the ancient tradition about what's going on. But that's a good point, that the dual mirror, we're talking about illuminating brightness. But this line is very nice because it says, in the middle of night, the true is bright. The character is bright. So in the middle of night, we're talking about in the dark night, reality is bright. So we're already mixing these two. Like we have in the merging of difference and unity too, right? Like right in darkness there's light, and right in light there's darkness.
And I like the word dawn. It has so many different senses, because something dawns on me. It also takes on a sense of knowledge.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
And like in knowing, you don't see it, or when things dawn, you know.
Yeah.
But also, of course, there's light appears.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Like, it dawns on us in some conceptual, discriminating way, then it disappears. Yeah, that's great. And maybe that, you know, that double meaning of dawn is kind of not just a coincidence, right? But it doesn't appear at dawn. So in the middle of night, the true is bright. And then it doesn't appear at dawn, it, the truth, the ultimate truth. When the light of dawn comes up and we start distinguishing things, that ultimate truth doesn't appear. You could say it's not really that it's lost. The ultimate truth doesn't go anywhere because it doesn't go or come. It just doesn't appear. In fact, it never appears, because we're talking about the ultimate truth of non-appearance and then the world of appearances. So in the world of appearances at dawn, this ultimate truth doesn't appear. But you could say it shines brightly at night. This is like dropping off body and mind, thinking of what doesn't think. There's like nothing happening, and yet it's totally alive. There's a bright clear awareness. It's not like dead, it's like totally alive. And Patrick mentioned the mirror, so in Hakuin Zenji's verses on these five positions that we'll probably have to get into at some point here, he talks about this first position is like the great death, basically, like dropping off everything. Nothing's happening. Being emptiness directly, and which would be like the darkness, yeah. And he says, this is when you realize the great perfect mirror wisdom. And he says, but amazing, or something like this, the great mirror is completely black at this time. So he mixes these. He says, when you first realize this great mirror wisdom at this first position, the mirror is totally black. So it's kind of, because there's nothing reflected in it. Then later, you emerge from this samadhi, this absolute samadhi of nothing happening, and then you start interacting with the world, and now the mirror is reflecting stuff, and it's light.
You know, in the Oxfording pictures, there's that one picture where it's empty.
Yeah, so these five positions can be correlated with the Oxfording pictures too. Offhand, I have to look at how it's traditionally they're correlated, but maybe that the empty circle there is like this first position. And there's going to be these circle diagrams coming too. So, and we can, to me, it's a lot of fun to like play with these different kind of systems and diagrams and images and stuff. And we just got to be careful not to take it too seriously. So, it acts as a guide for beings. Its use removes all pains, literally all suffering, all dukkha. So we're talking about the jewel mirror. It acts as a standard for all beings. Its use removes all pain. So this is its function, right? It's like, it's not just some funny mirror we're playing with. The use of this mirror removes all suffering. Quite something. Although it is not fabricated, it's not without speech. So earlier we had that line of the meaning is not in the words. Now we have this other side of it's not fabricated or constructed, the jewel mirror, but it's not without speech. In other words, a Buddha can speak. It's like words can come forth from this mirror. It's not illegal to say something. It's like the jewel mirror samadhi can speak. It's just that the meaning is not in the words, but speech can be used as a skillful means. Yeah.
Well, we were talking a lot about this. And actually, the whole hour that I was in there, my image was, what words are we using to explain this new experience of sitting or the mirror? But then I think you were kind of talking about, you know, when you write the 5,000 words and a few of them later on have some meaning. Maybe that was the expression of, you know, what is my speech when I'm more viscerally experiencing the mirror. You know, what's coming from my mirror mind that we found kind of what was the term that Rob was using? Visceral. That really kind of spoke from our true body. And that's another direction, even though that whole time I was, like Richard and I were talking, I was thinking, when we try to understand this noumenal life, the words that we come up with or that we're inspired with aren't quite there, but it gets us, keeps us interested. But this is another direction. This is what words come from the mirror mind.
And sometimes the same words, when we're more in touch with the mirror mind, strike us so strongly. I find, you know, after a few days of sesshin in Dokusan, it becomes like really alive, like conversations that maybe the subject's not any more deeper or interesting, but it's like each word coming out has is kind of like flowing, and the words are meeting and the conversation's going back and forth, and it's something, the words really like bring some new life and turning into the whole kind of relationship. Yeah.
That, I believe, happens because those words now, instead of coming from here, are coming from here.
That's maybe how we could say it.
Meditated for a few days.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore, maybe the more appropriate word happens to come out, or it might even be the same word, but it's really like...
It's connected.
Yeah, it's connected. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think this is part of our study here of words, is staying grounded in like where they're coming from. Very hard, right? See, once we get into this five positions thing and we get stay with it, it gets very heady. So related to this Baijiang, who is also brings up the present mirror awareness quite a bit, right? He says, there's no secret sayings. Those who come to realize thusness do not have a secret treasure. In the present mirror awareness, speech is distinctly clear. But if you seek forms and marks, ultimately they cannot be found. Speech is distinctly clear, yet it doesn't attach to the marks or signs or characteristics.
I'm going to try to express this, but I don't have much faith that I can be clear. But all this hour of conversation, you know, it seems to me simply about what's a lie or not, you know?
Hmm.
I can collect, I spent a lot of time collecting phrases, and it doesn't help me, you know, just like hanging on to phrases. But it's a spark, whether it's the meaning is not in the word, but it's a response. It's like alive right there, but there's nothing you can do with it, and there's no way that you can hold on to it. And I think the second iteration is really saying the same thing. It doesn't matter. It's not speech is, in other words, it's not saying speech is good in the first, second instance, and speech is bad in the first instance. It's all about the moment of contact or expression.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it makes sense to me. And I don't think those two things are saying really something different from each other.
And it can shift any time. It's just how awake we are to what's happening. Yeah, some cliche saying that's become really dead can suddenly come to life, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Oh, baby. Is that ever true?
Yeah. just this is it, or just this person. It's like, how many times do we hear that kind of thing in Zen, you know?
But because those truths, you know, become cliches.
Yeah.
And lose their meaning.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
At their death.
But then sometimes we hear it again. No, just this person, really. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, be here now. Sometimes, again, it's like almost a cliche. You know, coined by Ram Dass, right? A cliche of a whole generation. And yet, sometimes that really, that's completely, there's nothing, no other teaching than that. It says it all completely. It's all inclusive, penetrating the entire universe. Be here now.
Just don't put it in your pocket.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Make it into something. So a lot of this poem in words is about that relationship. He's going to keep going on in words, and yet don't put him in your pocket. It's like facing a jewel mirror, form and image behold each other. Or like, it's like drawing near a precious mirror, appearance and reflection see each other.
You know? I understand. That line, I don't understand what that means at all. Like, what's beholding?
Yeah, it's interesting.
How are there two things?
I was contemplating this too, with some question, Kathy.
Well, I think it's related to the following line.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we should read.
They do go together, yeah.
Facing a dual mirror, form an image, behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. I think it's a complete. So if we think of it that way, right? I don't know if that makes it clear, but you are not it. In truth, it is you. I mean, that's Dongshan.
You are not it. Or also we could translate again, the true is you, or the real. It's that character again, right? The ultimate. You are not it. The true position of the dark, that's you. And this line goes with the second of the five positions.
The second of the five positions is
called the true within the apparent. The first one's called the apparent within the true. So yeah, as we know, this comes from his Dongshan's awakening, where he looks at his reflection in this dream. His poem again goes. Well, it actually came from first. He had this conversation with his teacher, right? He's leaving his teacher, and he says, if later on someone asks how to depict you, what should I say? And Yunyan says, just this, or just this person, or just this is it, just this guilty one. And Dongshan is apparently lost in thought, and then Yunyan says something like, you now assume the burden of this great matter. You must be really thoroughgoing and take care of this. So then Dongshan leaves, and contemplating this, and sees his reflection in this dream, awakens to the dual mirror, and this verse comes to him in words. He says, earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. Earnestly avoid seeking outside yourself, lest this truth recede far away. Today I walk alone, yet everywhere I meet it, or him, my teacher. It now is no other than me, but I am not now it, or it now. It now, as the true, is me. It has that same character for true. I am not now it. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness. or thusness. It is not me, or no, it is not other than me. I am not it. So that's, in a way, maybe the center of this whole poem. Yeah. About how this dual mirror works, that kind of, I think, really great lines that we could contemplate for a long time. You are not it, it truly, in reality, is you. So we're talking about, if we're talking about it, is either the teaching of suchness or the dual mirror, same thing. To think that, I am just emptiness, is a little bit like, it's close, right? But it's to that, that's like carrying the self forward and experiencing the myriad things, where emptiness actually is me, is like the myriad things coming forth and experiencing me, confirming me.
I think it's really helpful to link those lines with these, because these used to seem really abstract to me, but when I read something that linked that, you know, you are not it, is the same as saying to carry yourself forward.
Yep.
Is delusion. Mm-hmm. Whereas in truth, it is you, is the myriad things realizing themselves through me. So then it makes that you are not it. That's like putting my ego.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You are not it. You are not your identity. In truth, it is you. You know? If I think I'm it, I'm putting myself out.
It being like emptiness or suchness, right?
Well, I don't know.
I think it's more subtle. We're talking about something quite subtle here.
Uh-huh.
It's to say, because we might think, like, we might even have some kind of insight that, oh, actually, I, the one I think I am, is emptiness. I think we're talking about is emptiness. So it's something that's pretty close to true, but it's not quite true, because we're still, there's some sense of carrying myself into this idea of emptiness, rather than emptiness is actually, or the dual mirror is confirming me. I'm just a reflection in this mirror.
But then how does that link then to the prior line that you're
next? Yeah, to yeah.
I suppose the second line would help us out, but I have no idea how.
Oh, you're not going to say?
Yes. I just have the exact same response as Nanette, because when I first read this, I thought, one way or another, this is a contradiction, because in a sense, what can observe emptiness? Can emptiness observe itself? Hence, can there even be a mirror? I mean, form, I could see how form can observe image, you know, and maybe image might respond, but how does emptiness respond to itself?
Inconceivably.
Thank you. So that's why, I mean, we're sitting here saying, man, I don't know what that is.
But it's true, yes?
No, I was going to say, isn't it, I mean, the way I interpret this line, mm-hmm. tell me your thoughts, is that, and I think it is confusing, because it's like, when you think of it objectively, it's this reflection, and it's, you know, it's sort of observing you as you're observing it, but it's, you know, it's all in the mind. Anyway, it's all the mind, it's all the mirror of the mind. So it's the realization that the reflection is its self too. That's my interpretation.
That the reflection.
Yeah, you said it's all part of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of the mind anyway. So it's observing you as you're observing it. It's,
they're not really two different things.
It's not two different things.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. But I think that is a tough line, actually. Also, the way we've been talking about, it's bringing in a third thing here, right?
Yeah. What's observing?
Yeah, we've been talking about just the mirror, which we could call like Buddha nature and reflectivity, receptivity, ultimate suchness, and then the appearances in the mirror. Those two things. Now we're saying there's the mirror, there's the image on it, and then there's some form that's looking, right?
Yeah.
And when I started thinking about that, I thought, wait a second, there isn't really a form there, is there? There's just the reflection. So we could hear it as that form or appearance maybe a stretch, because why would you call it a form or appearance? But what if it's like, that's Buddha? Buddha is looking at the reflection of me, and Buddha actually is the mirror too. So there's no difference here, really. But the reflection is the apparent image that's being reflected, and the form, maybe we can't actually find the form, because there's just the image, but it's almost in some inconceivable way there's an invisible form that has no characteristics, that's gazing at the reflection in the mirror. But it's a little bit funny to add in this third. I mean,
to me, ultimately, what we're saying is emptiness is aware of itself. And that is inconceivable.
It's aware of itself sometimes as a reflection, as an image,
right.
As an appearance.
How could it do that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's emptiness.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Yeah.
How did it's not even... separate, it's not a thing.
Well, right, but it's still, it doesn't work.
The truth is you.
We're talking, you know, Buddha nature is not just an absent void, it's aware emptiness, or empty awareness.
Emptiness. Mm-hmm. What a crazy idea.
Yeah, it's a crazy idea. And not dualistic awareness, it's knowing without touching things. It's just open awareness with no objects, and yet it's not just nothing. Aware is alive and awake, and because it's alive and awake, it can manifest as myriad types of reflections and appearances. And,
So did that help you again?
No.
I think we got to take away a hand or something.
Yeah.
He's trying to keep running around.
Form and image. Form and image behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. You could almost, like, if you didn't know that the it is referring to the actual dual mirror, which is how I would interpret it, then you could almost say, like, the form is it, and you are the image, or something like that. But I don't think that, I think that veers off from the point at hand.
And the second part is something, this line that Kathy was bringing forward is helpful, it's just not helpful in understanding the line that came before.
You are not it, in truth it is you. So again...
From his original story, all that...
Oh, from the original story?
All of that is fine. It's uh-huh. The...
Oh, about the line before. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I'm willing to totally let that go.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Well,
I'm willing.
Me too. You know, I mean, in a sense, we say, honor it and let it go.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts about that line?
Well, you know, at the same time that we are... totally inform bodies that we're tired, that we need more sleep, that we get to have another hour to this day instead of losing it. We can also work with the concept of our absolute true bodies so that that we are just sitting here as the results of flowing causes and conditions, and that there's nothing, there's no self here. So we can hold those two ideas at the same time. And that's how I see this.
But it doesn't say that form and the mirror are observing each other. It says that form and the image observe each other. But my response to it was,
That's all I've got.
That
I've given you the whole way. I've only given you 80%. Please, bring the other 20% home.
Well, for me, this felt like it's something really tender, like a mother and child see each other. Like, so it felt as if this was not coming from emptiness so much as the validating that we are form and that we see each other. That's what came to me.
Thank you. Truly, I mean, it's like that's just. It may have nothing to do with Dongchang Nidhi, but it's like coming from a totally different place that totally resonated for me. You know what I mean? Yeah. Especially
mother and child make to you. Yeah.
No, but it does happen.
The image looks back.
Yeah.
And we are, you know, we have got this fleshy part of us that likes to be seen and to see. One of my favorite lines from somewhere is, beneath the shadow of this tree, there is a ferry boat. And I have this, like, the big shadow of this tree, but still a ferry boat with people in it, jog, 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 going through the water. So that's what that line.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, when just practically speaking, looking in a mirror, you could say you and the image do see each other.
Yeah.
It's where we're almost like trying to match it up with our current understanding of the mirror metaphor is having a hard time, but
yeah.
He's just saying, forget that a minute, just like I'm just happen to be looking in the mirror in a very straightforward way.
Yeah. And then the next line then reminds you, you are not it and in truth it is you. Mm. Then it brings the two back together. Mm. But just for that moment, there's that heartfelt recognition.
Very nicely said.
Another possibility too is that the form is the mirror. So the mirror and the reflection are totally intimate. They behold each other in a funny kind of way. So here's another story about reflection that I think also brings out these two sides similar to the Gyanjar Koan you might have heard. Case 52 in the Book of Serenity. Actually, it's Saoshan, who is the one who put together these, commented on Dongshan's five positions, and is a student of Dongshan. So he seems like the mirror thing comes up with him too. So Saoshan asked Elder De, the Buddha's true reality body, the Dharmakaya, is like space. It manifests form in response to beings, like the moon in water. How do you explain the principle of response? We were talking about this some, I think, last time too, because we were talking about inquiry and response come up together. So the Dharmakaya mirror mind can respond. So this is a question about. It's actually a quote from some other Buddhist text where. Saying the Buddha's Dharmakaya, the true reality body, is like space, and yet it manifests form in response to beings, like the moon reflected in the water. It's like the moon, but it manifests like the reflection in the water. How do you explain the principle of response, Elder De? And, you know, that's what the sutra says. How do you explain it? And De says, very similarly, like a donkey looking in a well. Like a donkey, you know, peering over into the clear reflective water down in the well. It sees, you know, its face. I explain it like that. It's in a way, it's the same image, like the moon reflected in the water. But the donkey is kind of nice because it's kind of maybe the sense of it's a little bit of a sort of a dumb, slow animal. It's not quite like a horse. Just a plain old donkey, right? But it sees itself in the Dharmakaya, like the reflection. And Saoshan says, like Patrick, you said a lot indeed, but you only said 80%. Classic Zen thing. That's pretty good, but it's only 80%. And Du said, well, what about you, teacher? What would you say to finish off the other 20? Sarasan said, like the well looking at the donkey. So I think that's very similar to, you are not it. You are not the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is you. It's like, we think of, oh, well, it's like, it's our effort of like looking into the dual mirror and seeing ourselves. It's like, no, the dual mirror is looking at us all the time. Just these two sides and different poetic images. And then, just to add in another pair here, these two sides of Dharmakaya, beautiful verses that, this is Book of Serenity, Wansong, the commentator, writes a verse for each of these lines. So the verse for like the donkey looking at the well, the verse is, the falling flowers consciously go along with the flowing stream. So there's like a flowing stream of reality constantly flows. And the falling flowers, which are like us, mm-hmm. sentient beings or something, fall into the stream and are carried and consciously follow. We like, let's merge with the Dharmakaya. Let's consciously follow the flowing stream. And then the verse for like the well looking at the donkey is, the flowing stream mindlessly carries the fallen flowers along. So one is saying the falling flowers consciously, or you know, intentionally, effortlessly, effortfully follow the stream. That's like, I'm going to look into the dual mirror. The other is like, this flowing stream mindlessly, effortlessly, intentionlessly, just carries the flowers.
I agree with effortful love for the first one. I don't think that's...
Consciously is
yeah,
the...
consciously is different than... Because... the whole... Oh, it's kind of a Taoist. I mean, it just does not... Effort is kind of against the stream. Consciously and with intention, to me, is different than effort.
So, yeah, we could say conscious or intention is more subtle than effort. Yeah, so we could hear it maybe in both ways that, you know, to effortlessly try to realize the way is like carrying the self forward and experiencing myriad things, effortfully carrying the self forward. But then on a more subtle level, you could say, even if it's effortless, but it's still, there's still some conscious sense of oneself doing something, even effortlessly. Is still only 80%. Still, it's not the whole story. I mean, there's a way in which we could say that carrying the self forward and experiencing myriad things, maybe we could say that there is 80% of practice that's like that, even though Dogen says that's delusion.
That's where we practice.
That's where we practice. And then meanwhile, you could say at the same time, the myriad things at the very same time are coming forth and confirming us. Mm-hmm. Even in the midst of our struggle and effort, they're saying, well, you know, you can relax anytime here because you're being carried. Mm-hmm. I think it's Kodo Suwaki Roshi says something, talking about, he's got a little poetic expression about Zazen is like the night train carries us even when we sleep. Mm-hmm. I think that's the same thing as the flowing stream mindlessly carries the falling flowers. Even when we're so like not concentrated and everything, we're not getting anywhere. Actually, we're going 100 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We're effortlessly and intentionlessly both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it feels picky, but this idea of flowing mm-hmm. gives us a sense of something just naturally happening without cause. But nothing moves without cause. nothing can flow without gravity or angle. And so yes, you're flowing, but in a sense, it's not a free ride because something's having to cause something to flow.
Mm.
It's just my mind gets caught up in these little things. You know,
if we're talking about flowing in the usual sense, that yeah, it's because usually. It's an interesting point, which we're going to get to that line at some point. Reality constantly flows, and, which is interesting because usually we think of reality doesn't come or go or do move. Reality is just suchness is totally still.
What causes it to move?
And so even to say reality constantly flows is one of those lines. I think that's one of the... is that... I guess it doesn't have that that true character, but similar sense of like the unmoving truth is actually flowing. It's again these two sides come together. Yeah, like if there's conditions for it, in order for it to appear as flowing, there must be a mind and or a, you know, and time, a sense of time, and gravity or whatever. Yeah.
Thinking of it in terms of time, that we have a lifespan, and the flow is the we flow through this lifespan. We all have the sense of our.
We
our
seem life. To.
We tend to note how old we are, and note where we are in the scheme of things, and without that, there wouldn't be any motivation in terms of the relative world to bother. So for me, the flow, I think, is a life or multiple lives.
It's true, but I mean, in quantum physics, there could be worlds with no time.
So I think it is about the integration of the relative and the ultimate. If this just the line reality constantly flows, right now at least I hear that as the two sides, unmoving, unchanging reality, where in the pure Dharmakaya, nothing appears or disappears. And yet, in our lives, there's this appearance of flow. So it's the black and the white joined there. Also, in regards to you are not it. In truth, it is you. Bhajang again about. Present mirror awareness. Bhajang lived before Dungshan, but close to that time. He says, to say the present mirror awareness is one's own Buddha is words of measurement, words of calculation. It's like the crying of a jackal. So, to say that this present mirror awareness, or it, is my Buddha, is one's own Buddha. In a way, there's some truth to it, but to say it that way is words of measurement and calculation. But to actually inconceivably accept the fact that it is actually me, whether I recognize it or not, is letting the myriad things come forth, letting the mirror manifest as words and life and all of it. Like a babe in the world in five aspects complete, it does not go or come nor rise nor stand or abide. Baba wawa, is there anything said or not? So this is from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, one of the great Mahayana sutras of teaching Buddha nature. And these are the five aspects complete. It doesn't come. A baby and the Tathagata are similar in this way. They don't come. They don't go. They don't rise and they don't abide in one place either, and they don't speak. So baba wawa, those are the five. Is there anything said or not? So here's the actual sutra. In chapter 27 of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Buddha says, good disciple of Buddha, what is baby practice? Good child, a baby does not arise, stand up, come, go, or speak. And the Tathagata is just like this. Not arising means that the Tathagata never arises the signs of dharmas. We could say never gives rise to grasping characteristics of things. Not standing means that the Tathagata is not attached to any dharma. We could say maybe doesn't take a stand in any position. Not coming means that the Tathagata's bodily action is free of moving. Not going means that the Tathagata has already arrived at great parinirvana. So they're not going forward on the path. They've already arrived. Not speaking means that though the Tathagata teaches the Dharma for all sentient beings, in truth, he does not say anything. Why? That which has something to say is a conditioned Dharma. The world-honored Tathagata is not conditioned, and for this reason there's nothing said. Further, not speaking is as when a baby says things, but the words are not yet complete. Same as the Jhumir Samadhi. Thus, though there are words, there's no real speaking. In the same way that the Tathagata has words that are not understood. These are the secret words of the Buddhas. Though he does say things, sentient beings don't understand, and therefore it is said that he does not speak. Further, a baby speaks in long syllables. Similarly, the Tathagata speaks the long syllables wa and ba. So this looks like this is actually, Baba Wawa is actually coming from this sutra. So Baba Wawa is supposed to just be like baby talk, you know, nonsense baby talk. But here he's giving a kind of symbolic meaning. The Buddha says, ba means conditioned and wa means unconditioned. This is called a baby. Ba means impermanence and wa means permanence. When sentient beings hear the Tathagata say permanence, they take it to be the teaching of permanence and thus they cut off impermanence. This is called baby practice. So it's kind of like, it's nonsensical in anything. But actually, there's this hidden meaning in Baba Wawa. It's like the two sides again, right? It's like conditioned and unconditioned. The two truths, the black and the white in Baba Wawa. Two syllables. Amazing. And, by the way, I think in Chinese it's po po ho ho. In the original it would sound something like that. There's that there's this case in the Blue Cliff Record, case 80, a monk asks Jiaojiao, does a newborn baby have the sixth consciousness? And Jiaojiao said, it's like tossing a ball on swift-flowing water. The monk also asked Totsu, what's the meaning of tossing a ball on swift-flowing water? And Totsu said, moment-to-moment, non-stop flow. This is how a baby experiences the world. It's talking about, is it the sixth consciousness, like discriminating mind with subject and object? And in this infant, it's just more like a ball on swift flowing water, non-stop flow. The commentary says, though a newborn baby is equipped with the six consciousnesses, though its eyes can see and its ears can hear, it doesn't discriminate among the six sense objects. At this time, it knows nothing of good and bad, superior and inferior, right and wrong, gain and loss. A student of the way must become again like an infant. Then one cannot be moved by praise or blame, success or fame, trial or ease. So, yeah, it's because of these discriminations that we we suffer because we're so adult. And we have this story. This is in Tenzin Roshi's Being Upright. When Sugen Narasaki Roshi was a young monk, he went to study with Suzuki Roshi's second teacher, Kishizawa Ion. It was a special week of studying these Dharma transmission documents of Soto Zen. And he said that he understood almost nothing that week. But there was one phrase of Kishizawa Roshi's that he did remember, which is, "We must have a mind like an infant, and if we lose it, we cannot be Buddha." That's so great. He didn't remember anything except that, which is pretty infant-like. It's pretty good, right? Got that part. Just be like a fool, like an idiot, like a child. Is there anything said or not? Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet true. This is the third occasion of this character, true. So some would say this is associated with this third position, coming from within the true, it's called. Coming from within the true. Ultimately, this dual mirror doesn't apprehend anything. Remember, it doesn't touch. It's aware without touching things. Because its speech is not yet true. Its speech, even though it's not without speech, the speech is not actually the true. Back and forth. First we hear the meaning's not in the words. Then we hear it's not without speech, though. And now we hear its speech, though, is actually not true. Mm-hmm. Back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Question.
Yeah.
Is a dog bark true?
Maybe more true, actually, than human speech, but more like an infant. Tentatively, I think we could say dog's bark may be true. But us saying that's not true. Because it's a discriminating thought. The dog's bark is... I mean, maybe if it's saying, "That person's an enemy, I gotta get them out of my yard," then it's not true. But if it's just like on the beach, and like splashing in the waves and just says rah, then it's true. Maybe.
What does that mean? Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything?
It doesn't, I think it still, virtually always when the word it appears here, I think is it's fair to say that it keeps referring to this dual mirror awareness. So ultimately, in the end, this dual mirror actually doesn't apprehend anything, or like we've been talking about this poem of Hunger saying about Zazen, the mind of Zazen is knowing, awareness without touching things. Same thing as apprehending things or touching things is like a dualistic subject-object contact. So it doesn't, this dual mirror, it doesn't apprehend things, but it reflects perfectly. I think apprehend, let's see, what's another word there? It might be kind of like grasp. Apprehend is a little bit like grasp. It doesn't attain or get or acquire things. Is actually more what that character means. Doesn't gain, attain, obtain things. Yeah, so apprehend, I think, the meaning of, in this case, of touching things and apprehending things means to grasp, subtle grasping of dualistic consciousness. His speech is not yet correct. Uh-oh.
It's really good. That's really good. The second part of the sentence.
It's like the six lines of the illumination hexagram, relative and ultimate, interact. Piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. Yeah, so I guess it's time. I got another handout for this one. And you can bring it back next time. Here's the... Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. Now, this has got the I Ching hexagrams, the colored circles, and the five positions. It's got, so this is all, by the way, Charlie Picorni's collection here has like 50 pages or more just on these five positions. And he's got, you know, pages of charts like this. So this is I just copied and pasted this summary, my kind of favorites and most straightforward. And, you know, we're going to do a class on this summer. So maybe we'll use this handout for that too. It's on the five positions of apparent and real as connected with the dual mirror samadhi. So, I should maybe preface this by saying that this five positions or five ranks of Soto Zen it's a Soto Zen teaching from China, but it looks like Dogen was not so keen on this. You know, he knew about it because it's a classic teaching of Dongshan, but I think he thought it just gets too gnarly and complicated and intellectual. So he's like, he actually refers to it. Mm-hmm. You can actually see, I actually put Dogen's Genjo Koan correlation of these five positions here. So there's things like that, and some people say it's all through the Shobo Genzo, these five positions, but he doesn't call them that. But the same dialectic is there. So still after Dogen, various Japanese Soto teachers did bring it up again and commented on it, and it's kind of come and gone, and some people scorn it and some praise it, and basically the scorning just generally comes from like, it just gets too, I mean, if you start reading Charlie's stuff about this, and I didn't bring, but I have this other whole book of like, all these, you know, this is just one version, all these ways these symbols play out and linked up with all different kinds of other symbols, and it's just very theoretical. Yeah. But it points to like, Buddha's mind, different aspects. I think it could be really helpful as a practice thing. In Rinzai Zen, it's actually been kept alive, interestingly, even though it's been kept alive as a teaching. Did you study five ranks?
The final koan.
The final koan. Is these, yeah, so.
And then the precepts, actually.
Oh, okay.
This, and then when you think you're done, it's like, oh, and now I'm going to do
the Bodhisattva precepts are the final end, with these five ranks, particularly with these verses of Dongshan, is that what you use in the koan?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Hakuin, the great Japanese reviver of Rinzai Zen, was into these, so we have his commentaries. This is just a little excerpt from his on the bottom column row here, describing them. But we can, maybe this summer, we can look into his whole, like maybe five-page essay on these. And basically, just to go over this chart, these are the titles. The fourth one has these two different titles because sometimes it's arriving in both seems to be the usual one, but sometimes Dongshan actually, and Saoshan, his student, got really into this too, and they all have all these different verses on these five. But sometimes it's called arriving in the apparent instead of arriving in both, and there's a bunch of arguments about which is more appropriate. So these, and then the I Ching, y'all know the I Ching, I assume?
No, this, not really.
What it is, though, anyway?
No, it is.
It's, you know, it's this, some say the oldest book in the entire world, I think. It might be more like from around Buddha's time, like 500 BC, somewhere around there, in China. And it's like a book of wisdom, but I think even in the early days it was used for divination, and now it's mainly used for divination. And it's a popular thing in America in the 60s. I think people got really into the I Ching. And it gives great answers. Yeah, people often use three coins. You can also use 50 yarrow stalks, which is a nice mindful way to... I do this periodically, use the call on the I Ching. you can ask it a question and it'll always answer correctly. Yeah. It doesn't give you yes and no answers. It gives great wisdom answers. And it's made up of, there's these eight trigrams, which a trigram means three lines. And if you do eight times the eight trigrams, you get 64 combinations. And that's the 64 hexagrams, which are the six line things. And each one of them is a different, these 64 answers that you get when you do this divination, 64 possibilities. And they're made up of these solid and broken lines. And so this is where the complication could start here, is that generally in this system of the I Ching, the split line is a yin line, and the solid is a yang line. And then in terms of like yin and yang, you know, it's like that black and white symbol, Taoist symbol, so that we have the black and white thing, right? So my understanding is that generally yin is the black and yang is the light. Yang is like the active, expressive, in the world. Yin is like the passive, receptive. Yeah, or masculine and feminine sometimes. And so black and white goes with our discussion, it works that way, right? That yin would be black as the receptive, non-doing. And the active appearance in the world is like the light. So that may be where these first Zen people like merging of difference and unity got into black and white is from this yin and yang. But I'm not sure if necessarily if the broken yin lines we can necessarily correlate with the black ultimate truth. I think there's some it looks like in some commentaries they reverse that a little bit. More like the true, because we have these things true and leaning, right? So it's almost like the solid line would be like the true and the broken would be like the leaning. But to make the whole thing fit together for our purposes, and we can play with this in many ways because there's no definitive agreements on how these work. We could make it all fit together by saying the split line is yin, and yin receptive is actually like the ultimate. My teacher likes to say that this double, the illumination hexagram is the last, is number 30 on the right here. The double split hexagram, we sometimes say. And that, it's made up of these two trigrams of the yang surrounding the yin. So Tenshin Roshi likes to say, this is like, and this is Dungshan's ultimate, you know, symbol for the dual mirror samadhi. And Soto Zen practice is like a kind of strong masculine exterior with a receptive feminine interior.
Yeah.
I think that's a very cool way to look at it. I don't know if that's in the traditional commentaries, but that trigram and doubled, two trigrams doubles it, is it looks like our forms are very exacting, right? Do it this way, and it's very kind of exacting and specific, active, do it like this. And it may be kind of rigorous, effortful, masculine approach, scares some people away from Zen practice. But the heart of the meditation is the receptive samadhi. It's like the dual mirror. It just receives, it just holds everything very, very gently. So that's a nice image, I think. Soto Zen trademark sort of symbol. So that's the illumination hexagram. Number 30 is each one's associated with an element, each of the trigrams. So it's the fire trigram, which is also sometimes connected with illumination. Sometimes we say the illumination hexagram. Beauty, clinging, interestingly, is one translation of this in the I Ching. These are the numbers if you want to look at an I Ching and look up that. You can read the whole commentary on each of the hexagrams. But clinging and separating, right? If you look it up in a modern Chinese dictionary, it means like letting go or separating. which is the opposite of clinging.
Yes.
But most people say it doesn't mean like clinging, like grasping, attachment. It's like the clinging of that fire clings to its fuel. So it's like almost like dependent, the intimacy of dependent co-arising. We could say that kind of clinging, I think, is a good way to look at it. You know, whole, like a fire only blazes when it's totally intimate with its fuel, which is the world of experience. So you could see Sao Shan, Dengshan's student, call them host, guest, host coming to light, guest returning to host, host within the host, which is in Dengshan's poem here. Host is, of course, the ultimate, and guest is the relative. And so it's about this relationship of host, and the host is the mirror, and the guest is all the reflections that come and visit the mirror and have tea and go. Sao Shan's circles. This is something you can just start contemplating. If you want, you can see it's the black and the white. The apparent within the real is like the white is starting to come into the black. You can see all these circles as a kind of movement. Like the white is kind of squeezing it. It's almost dark, but there's some white coming in. And the next, it's almost white, but there's a little bit of ultimate coming in. Then the spot, you could see it as the spot. If you see it in the dynamic moving way, you could see it like the ultimate is in the center and it's getting bigger and bigger. It's moving outward to fill the circle. Or you could see it as it's shrinking into the center. The plain white is like completely relative, although it's called arriving in both, and then attainment in both is the total black. And then here's the Jhumir Samadhi with his five lines that we're talking about, with where the true character appears in each of them. You know, I've kind of retranslated it to put true or real in each of those lines. Those are the five places that character appears. This other, and that's what Taigen Layton proposes, is the five positions in the dual mirror samadhi. Lu Kuan Yew, Charles Luke, this is his, I think he probably didn't make up, he's probably got from a Chinese commentary, this is his take on these five different lines of the dual mirror samadhi associated with the five ranks. You can see one of them, the first one is actually the same, but the others are different. Dengshan's verses are in the record of Dengshan. These are the classic verses he gives on each. These are particularly, he's called his verses on the five positions. So that's not just randomly separated. That's like five different verses. And they're titled The Apparent Within the Real. And then he writes this verse, The Real Within the Apparent. He writes that verse. And they're wonderful, strange verses, but they really point, if you really take them up, they really point at the meaning of these positions. When Hakuin writes his essay, he says, people get all confused about this five ranks thing, but he says, my teacher said, just study Dengshan's verses, don't read all the other commentaries. So I think they are really great. And the way the Genjo Koan fits in there, you see the first two columns are reversed from the way they actually are in the Genjo Koan. At least that's the way I would propose that they be set up. And then a little bit of Hakuin's commentary, which is quite a bit longer in the bottom there. So you can contemplate that and study that over the next week. But this is the six lines of the illumination hexagram. Relative and ultimate interact. Piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. So we could talk about next time how, basically, it looks like the first three are the piled up, they make three. And then the complete transformation makes all five. But how, we can talk about how you might be able to figure it out by looking at these hexagrams, how you can break up the hexagram to make these first three. I'll just note that, the first two hexagrams are made up of equal trigrams, just like number 30. They're, you know, the top and the bottom are identical.
Yeah.
And same with, so some people actually say these are two trigrams, and then when you pile up the two, when you put one trigram on top of the other one, you get this one, and when you put the other one on top, you get number four. So you can see how that works. But they're all, and there's a lot of I Ching kind of lore in here, and basically that the last hexagram, this illumination one, is said to be the most stable and complete hexagram. It's not the lot, it's, you know, number 30 out of 64, but the structure of it is most balanced, and that's what Dongshan chooses as his, like, dual mirror samadhi. But it does have yang. The ones that are not stable are the ones that are like either all yang or all yin. But the ones that are like mixed in these various ways are most stable.
Well, I was looking at the black circle.
Yeah. Oh yeah, black circle. But the hexagram you can see has yin and yang lines.
Right.
So yeah, so that's a little clear right there how maybe why they choose this is the most stable and complete. I Ching hexagrams have a balance of relative and ultimate, right? They don't fall into either side. So that's part of this dual mirror is like that. Sorry. This part's tough. This is where it's hard to like let the words come from the dual mirror. It's complications, twining vines. May all beings enjoy the myriad things, confirming them moment by moment, like being carried in the flowing stream. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I